This is the Infotainment Podcast, the vaccine to the disinformation virus. The world has never been better connected than it is today, and yet getting your message across during a public health emergency seems to be increasingly challenging. New research published recently by the Center for Countering Digital Hate shows that anti-vaccine campaigns and other conspiracy theories about COVID-19 are influencing what people think about the virus and making it less likely that some will take the vaccine when it's developed. I'm Damien Collins, and I'll be discussing these and other issues with John Borthwick, the CEO of BetaWorks, and who for the last two decades has been an entrepreneur and early-stage investor in New York technology, working with companies including Twitter and Giphy. He also chairs the COVID-19 Tech Task Force in America. John, it's great to have you on the Infotainment Podcast. It's over 2 years since we first met at your offices in New York when I was there with the DCMS Select Committee for our investigation into disinformation and fake news. And you said something in that meeting that I particularly remembered, and I think it's been a theme of a number of the podcasts that we've had with Infotainment. And that's when we talk about the data that's gathered about people, what they're interested in, and how that can be used. We sometimes talk about that in the context of, well, how can we be more effective at dealing with medical conspiracy theories, disinformation, harmful content, and so on. And I remember what you said in the meeting is that the technology that is used to gather data to run ads can be used to do all sorts of things, not just target advertising at people. And I think that's absolutely true. And I think for me, that's why a lot of the things we've been talking about in this podcast are about disinformation as both a content problem, something bad that we should identify and warn people about. But there's also a data side to disinformation as well, which is about how it spreads through the web. And I think that's an area where the tech companies do have some responsibility, because it's their tools that are amplifying and manipulating that content and getting it in front of other users. And I'd really welcome your thoughts on this and what we can do about it.
Yeah, so nice to see you, sort of see you again. I mean, I think that I think about this a few ways. So in my day job at BetaWorks, I do a lot of work with startups, and we were very involved in the early days with Twitter, Tumblr, sold a few companies to Facebook. So we sort of know this social web pretty well. And then in the last couple of months, I've been running this COVID tech task force here in the US. And so I've been thinking about disinformation in the context of COVID. What's happening now. And I think that to go to the heart of your question, Damien, is since I saw you a couple of years ago, is that what we've seen is state actors, non-state actors, individuals weaponize these tools and figure out how to spread disinformation at scale. So much so that today I think we're sort of living in this hazy hall of mirrors where we don't really know what is real. There was a post I saw this morning, with seemingly benign post. Somebody sent me of a flood of water in the Lincoln Tunnel. And my first thought, this post on Instagram, my first thought was, is this a real video? And did this actually happen in the last couple of hours? Or is this a video from a couple of years ago that somebody is reposting and claiming it's happening now in order to drive clicks and in order to drive attention? So the attention economy is fundamentally broken at this point.
Absolutely. And I think that's right, certainly in terms of fake content. And we've heard numerous stories about conspiracy theories that have spread. A recent version of the podcast with Irish MP James Lawless said that there was a recording of someone from the Irish military warning of a martial law style lockdown of the whole country, which was shared on WhatsApp very widely. And we've seen in the UK lots of disinformation stories about the NHS during COVID. And I think we need to achieve a bit of a mindset shift where people don't share stuff because it's interesting and might be true, but they try and find out whether it is true first. But I mean,
I think the really complicated thing here is that we're seeing the development of entirely, we talk about this as disinformation and fake news, and we think about it as single pieces, right? So a single thing about something happening in Ireland. And in fact, what you have is that you have an entire parallel information system where people have built this sort of brick by brick, these, you know, fabricated narratives. And then you slot in that last brick, like there's a state, you know, takeover that's underway. And you and I look at it and just look at the brick, and they're looking at the whole wall. And so it's not just the single pieces of disinformation. It's that we're creating these parallel universes of narratives, and it is just making it seriously challenging to have civil discourse and to function in a democracy, which is exactly the intention of a lot of these people who are posting this stuff.
Absolutely.
To create anarchy or to create chaos.
Absolutely. I mean, Mark Zuckerberg has found himself in the sort of eye of the storm on this now, I think, particularly with, you know, advertisers and other organizations saying that they need to do more to act against hate speech and harmful content. Do you think they know what to do? I mean, do you think they are objecting because of their philosophical objections, or because they're not entirely certain how to sort of fix the monster they've helped create?
Yeah, so I think it's a bit of all of the above. I mean, I think that these people are first and foremost, they're mostly well-intentioned people who are just trying to build their business, and that they've built this monster, right? And that they don't really know what to do. I also think that the fundamental monetization, or, you know, the link to the attention economy, is sort of the one of the vectors that is fundamentally broken. So it's like everything you try and do in the context of some of these platforms is you're just like it's a trade-off between monetization and truth and civil discourse, and that is not a healthy place to be. So I think that these companies are fundamentally sort of are conflicted at the core. I also think that we as users have given them just a incredible amount of latitude, right? And so in terms of trust, in terms of use of their products, in terms of our use of our data, we've just handed over to them, sort of like let them into the home and, you know, turned our Alexa devices on and said, you know, listen away, we trust you. And so I think that there's a lot on us. And then I think governments have also, you know, turned a blind eye to this because it's been a primary area of growth, because frankly, I don't think most people in government have understood this, right? And if we look what's happening now with COVID tech, there are ample examples of people in government just not understanding what's happening. And because it feels like a good growth story. I'm just going to hype some tech and, you know, just get behind some tech, and it will sort itself out. And I think that's now, you know, people in my industry call this a tech backlash. I don't see it as a tech backlash at all, because the, you know, that implies there's going to be a swing back, right? It's a swing of the pendulum. I don't see it as that. I see it as the maturity of tech, and tech has to, you know, like the chemical industry in the 50s, has to just grow up and figure out how to, it's going to be regulated, and it has to figure out how to both stand up to its responsibilities, but also integrate itself into public health, into all of the industries that it's upending in a functional way that actually gets us to a future we want to live in.
Yeah, I think that's so important. I mean, I think we've talked about this on the podcast before, but I think because, you know, when people raise these objections or concerns or make the case for some form of new system of regulation, often they're accused of being anti-tech, but I think that's a bit like saying you're anti-car because you think seatbelts are a good idea. You know, so
yeah.
Yeah. Most, you know, things for sure. And I think we've seen an interesting debate around the when the UK on the NHS track and trace app, and in other countries as well, about, I think actually, you know, citizens rightly asking questions about, well, okay, I understand why this could be a good idea and I might even use the app, but what exactly are you going to do with the data, and what happens at the end when the app's destroyed, and, you know, what will you use it for then? And I think that's in some ways shows that the kind of debate maturing and people having a keener sense of questions they should be asking.
Yes, and I think that I think what's happened in the last month sort of betrays and shows all of the complexity and the problems that we're facing as it relates to tech and society, right? I think that you have politicians who went out with, you know, good intentions, went out early and said, hey, we're going to try and use technology to solve this. I think you had politicians who went out early and sort of played into sort of techist theater. In other words, like, hey, I could just wave an app and it will go away, which was completely misguided. So I think we saw that, both of those two things. And then you saw tech companies where I think Apple and Google here have created a infrastructure and a that is privacy preserving, right? That's a term that people in the industry use to mean that it's not completely locked down, but it is more privacy preserving than you would ever expect Apple and Google would put into market or tech companies would put into market. I think what they did was brilliant, and yet it required a whole bunch of other steps and systems to be put in place, namely that all this stuff, contact tracing, is a public health system that no single app is going to be able to solve or do. The app is just a small piece of that puzzle. And so, and it can be, there's data now that suggests, I mean, even coming out of Ireland, going back to Ireland, there's, you know, in the last 2 weeks, they've launched their Apple, Google-based exposure notification system with a symptom tracker in it. And I think it has the potential to mitigate and slow the spread if and only if it's used as part of a coherent policy around testing, tracing, isolation, probably support for mental health issues, and just it's an entire system. And contact tracing is part of that, and exposure notifications is just a small techie piece of it. Yeah, so.
For the benefit of the podcast, perhaps just give us a bit of background to what you're doing with your COVID tech task force.
Yeah, so the COVID tech task force was came together, and you should think about it. I think about it almost like an open source project. Right? It came together with a set of people in the tech industry. I was not one of the founders. This guy Josh Mendelson was founded it, and Josh was he was very involved in the response to Katrina. And at that time, he was working at Google, and he helped put in place a lot of the. He used a lot of tools at Google to help the first responders with tracking during Katrina. He did a great job of that. So Josh and a group of people started this back in February, March, and they came to me in April and said, I think it was April. God, it feels 6 months ago now. Time has taken on a whole new shape, right? Yeah, so they came to me and said, hey, would you step in and help run this? And so what we've been doing is we've done a series of, got a series of work streams. We just finished last week a big hackathon that we did where we had thousands of people participating, and it was focused on mental health issues and social isolation. And so we did that. A couple of weeks prior to that, we did a big conference where we also had a couple of thousand people on it, which was looking at all the contact tracing apps. We were trying to, we put together a set of speakers on the conference. You know, this is all in Zoom land, right? But we also put together almost like a shopping mall of all the options. So public health officials could go, oh, I can see what they're doing in Utah. I can see what they're doing in New York, or I can see what a symptom tracker is. So, and right now we're working on a back to school, a similar event around back to school, and we're also working on some PSAs. So we're an informal group, all volunteer based. I squeezed this in around my day job, and as I've had all of us, and there's a couple of hundred tech companies who have been involved in one capacity or another, and everybody's just trying to figure out how they can help.
And where could be, is there an open sort of a repository of the work that's been done so far?
Yeah, so since we don't have a, so the conference I just mentioned was, we ran it on TechCrunch, and we also partnered with Harvard Berkman on it. The hackathon I mentioned is up on DevPost. We have a small Twitter account where we post some of this stuff. I mean, frankly, we've been working so quickly, we haven't figured out a destination, because we're in my ideal scenario, this organization goes away. The other founder of this was Ron Conway, who's one of the preeminent angel investors on the West Coast, and he was supposed to actually call me up with Josh and said, "Hey, can you jump in, help run this thing?" And it's just been moving from project to project. I mean, at the beginning, the organization was helping move ventilators around the country. And so it's, you know, that period of, you know, absolute, you know, hands-on panic back in, you know, April, you know, now feels a lifetime away. But in a sense, it's not, because, you know, here in the United States, we're just having a very hard time dealing with this pandemic. And part of that is because I think we have the information systems have collapsed. And a good part of that is because of technology, or because of most of it, because of Facebook.
Yeah. I mean, do you mean that by information systems collapsing, do you mean that the people's ability to access reliable information is compromised by the sort of the fake news networks that run through social media and leave people not knowing what to believe?
So I mean something different, but what you just said is the case also. What I mean is that, you know, we used to have an information hierarchy, and that has collapsed. And so now we have this, you know, we've developed this incredibly, you know, connected, nimble, organic information network that, you know, we're sort of doing this massive information social experiment on ourselves in real time as we live through a pandemic, which is probably just not a good idea. And these information systems that we have, this network-based latent information systems, you know, the beauty of it is it lets you, you know, start up a podcast and, you know, get that to scale and get a whole bunch of people who are listening to it and go to it direct, right? And so that would have been unheard of 50 years ago. You would have had to go to the BBC or to, you know, to a radio network and have a distributor. So there's, you know, incredible benefits to this. But all of the, you know, I use the analogy of the chemical industry in the 50s is just like, you know, pharmaceuticals and chemicals and, you know, have changed the world, mostly for the better. But in the 50s, they ran rampant and, you know, it required regulation, and we required society to understand that, you know, just pouring, you know, weed killer on your little garden in the back of your house was probably not the best idea for the longevity of, you know, if you had some tomatoes and then you wanted to eat or something, right? And so we just needed to learn all this stuff, and we're doing the same thing again, right? We have to, this new information network is fundamentally reorganizing society, and we have to, all of our systems have to adapt to it. The problem is it's happening way faster than we've ever seen before. And that means that wealth is being accrued way faster. It means that change is happening faster. It means our systems are really struggling to adapt, because I think most of our systems just take time to adapt to these things.
And I mean, where do you think change will come from? I mean, the regulatory model, it implies that governments will set standards and regulatory bodies that will work with the tech companies, and the tech companies will have to adapt. And do you think it will be through the adaption of the big tech companies to new standards that are required of them? Or do you see new companies arriving, new services, new ways of working with data in the web, which will, you know, replace in part some of the big tech companies of today?
Yeah, so I have, so early on in my career, I mean, I've always been a tech entrepreneur, but early on in my career, I spent about a year working on the Microsoft antitrust case, right? And I testified against Microsoft in that for a couple of days. And after that experience, I became actually fairly, pretty darn skeptical of the efficacy of regulatory sort of addressing these concerns through regulatory tools, because it just seemed too slow and it didn't seem that effectual. And going back to Microsoft, it's like, you know, the marketplace, you know, sort of the marketplace did respond, and I think dealt with that more effectually than government necessarily did. However, today I think that we're in a different place, and this is far, far more, it's far larger. It's, you know, we're talking billions of people on Facebook, and that single platform. And we have to figure out some regulatory guardrails around these companies. Coupled with that is that I think that we have to, there's a whole other set of things that need to be put in here, because I don't want to, I think government is only a piece of the puzzle, right? So I think we've got to understand how we're thinking about data as users, and we've got to really question, you know, whether we want to do that with our data, right? And that intersects with new startups, right? So, you know, we have a program which we're running right now at BetaWorks called Beta Lab, where we are funding new startups that are doing, using new models around privacy and data, doing disinformation tracking and these tools. Right, going back to that incident this morning, Damien, where somebody sent me this video and I was like, is this real? I want to be able to go somewhere and just check that. Now, ideally, I would like Instagram and Twitter to flag it immediately, which they have capabilities around that. But I would like to also just be able to take that video, just plug it into a tool and just check it. Check the, so those tools, I mean, I think today are, they're just starting to be developed, and there needs to be more development, there needs to be more capital, there needs to be more interest in that area of development, because I think we have to regulate, I think we have to change user behavior, I think we have to innovate. And I think the innovation access is as important as any of the others.
I think that's really important, because I found as a politician, you know, questioning big tech companies in hearings, you know, you can identify the problem, but what you're trying to find out is there a solution to that problem. Often the big tech companies are not very keen to volunteer whether they believe there is a solution to the problem, if it's not a problem they necessarily want to fix unless they're made to. And so it's always really helpful when other companies come along and say, well, no, actually, there is a way you could fix that. There's a way you could deal with that problem, and we've got the technology to do it. And that sort of innovation, I think, is a great way of demonstrating what's possible, and makes it also possible then for governments to challenge the big tech companies and say, well, look, you can see it can be done, so why don't you do it?
Right. I think that's exactly right. And I think it happens at the micro level with individual features, like tracking disinformation on these platforms, which I think, and so it happens at that level, but it also happens at the entire platform level, where there will be services, and there are services that are emerging that are competitors to Facebook itself, that are being, that they're monetized in different ways, and that are basically saying to users, hey, if you come over here, you can do all that good stuff you're doing, but the monetization model is different, so therefore we don't need to own your data and you can keep your data. And so I think that so it's happening at every level of the stack. But you know, the speed at which this is both developing and unraveling is astounding. And as we get to, you know, if we get to a vaccine, right, which all of us, I think, are looking at and saying, okay, that is the sort of, you know, that's the point at which we can get back to a normal functioning society. When we get to that point, there is going to be an entire wave of disinformation. You can see it starting now around the anti-vaxxers. I saw a video yesterday that is actually, it's being distributed in France right now. And it was a constructed 10-minute documentary that explained that the 30 to 50 million people who died in the 1918 pandemic, that flu, the 1918 flu, was in fact not contagious. And those people died because of vaccinations. I mean, that is, you know, I'm reaching for not to swear, but that's just, it's fucking nuts.
Yeah.
It's like, yeah, I mean, the 1918 flu was so contagious that people would get it within 2-3 days of exposure, very different to COVID. And I just wrote a book about it, and it's people could be dead within 24 hours of getting it. With 12 hours, they'd be half black. And then they'd be like blood would be coming out of their ears. And people are saying that's because it is crazy. And that's the information system that we've collapsed. And so, you know, fabricated media, fabricated trust used and monetized through these platforms is we have to figure out how to address this as a society, because if not, we won't understand what is real.
Absolutely. I think this is the big challenge, isn't it, I think, with on disinformation, that when we've got the vaccine and we're in a position where we need 80-85% of people to take the vaccine for it to be the most effective it can be, and yet we're fighting this disinformation war. And there's been some research published in the UK in the last week that shows that about a third of people have been exposed to disinformation, anti-vaccine disinformation, say they don't want to take the vaccine when it comes. They don't think it'd be safe to take it. I think it is influencing behavior. And I just don't think it'll be enough for you know, people like Mark Zuckerberg to say, well, it's all about freedom of expression and people have got a right to share this stuff if that's what they believe, you know, when we can see there are real world consequences of public health of those lies being spread. John, just a couple more questions for me before we finish. Firstly, I think one of the companies that you were involved with at BetaWorks was Giphy, which has now been sold to Facebook, and there's quite a lot of interest in that. I mean, do you think there's a danger that companies like Facebook are getting too big through not just their own organic growth, but through further acquisitions?
So, I mean, I think that Facebook is... I describe the reach. It's astounding how effective this company has been at growth, and much of that growth has come through acquisitions. The major acquisitions that Facebook has made that really matter are the ones that have developed completely new destination apps with new graphs of people that they wouldn't have touched otherwise. In other words, Instagram or WhatsApp. And Giphy, Giphy was acquired a couple of months ago. It was actually acquired by Instagram. I know Instagram is part of Facebook, so it's technically it's Facebook, but it was the Instagram team who wanted and were interested in acquiring Giphy, and the Giphy team wanted to do a deal with them. And the rationale behind it was fairly simple, which is that, you know, Giphy delivers GIFs, but also stickers. And it had become, in the last 2 years, huge within Instagram. And so it was almost like it was becoming a feature within Instagram, because users were using so many GIFs and so many stickers through Instagram. And so they just became such a large partner that it made sense for it to, as a feature, to become part of the company.
Yeah. Okay. And I mean, just on a sort of final note, are there any, I don't know if you're able to talk about them, but from what you've been doing recently and looking at some of the challenges we've discussed on the podcast, are there things that give you hope? Are there things you've seen that you think are exciting and could really play a role in solving some of these problems, particularly around disinformation that we've talked about?
Yeah, I do. I mean, I think that there's technologies which we're starting to see that are allowing people, users, brands, advertisers, platforms to be able to identify manipulated videos, manipulated audios, streams. And so there's companies around that I'm very interested in and very excited by. So I would put that into the sort of area of tracking and detection. I would say that there's alternative social networks we talked about a few minutes ago that are starting to pop up. I would also say that there are privacy tools and also privacy. The world of privacy and data, I believe, is going through a sort of step function change right now, where there are tools out there that, and tools is the wrong word, there are methodologies that are being developed, mostly within research, but some of them have been rolled out at scale, that actually let you take massive data sets and anonymize them. and make sure that an individual can now be identified within that data set. Because it turned out that the one of the assumptions of privacy in data sets has been that if you have a large enough data set and that you don't have personally identifiable information in that data set, I don't know who Damien is. Damien's in the data set. I've got his behavior in there, but I don't know who he is. And so therefore you're anonymous. Well, it turns out that that is false. And it's been demonstrated by Facebook in spades and then by other companies and other researchers. It's false because I can take another data set where I do have Damien's name and I can compare it to the former data set and I can find Damien in that by cross-correlating your behavior. And so, and then in the case of Facebook, in a lot of cases, they actually do have name and they have phone number and they have all this information on you. And so the presumption that large data sets, anonymized data sets are in fact anonymous has turned out to not be the case. And there's a whole area around differential privacy and split privacy or federated that is that's happening right now that I'm fascinated by and that which is ways that you can actually embed into these algorithms. Systems to both anonymize, but also to say, okay, I want to make sure that this particular algorithm isn't biasing certain segments of the population. And the way we've been doing that for the last 10, 15 years is by saying, if the following bad outcomes happen in this algorithm, then we'll go back into the algorithm and adjust it. And what we're starting to see now is we're starting to see ways to be able to program into the algorithm where you define bias or justice as elements in the algorithm. And then the algorithm can start to internally adjust before we get the bad outcomes. So it knows that if you tip beyond a certain level of either bias or unfairness with some criteria associated with that, some objective criteria associated with that, that it can then adjust internally. And so I think there's whole areas of data science that are starting to emerge that can actually address some of these issues. We just need them to be developed, get out there at scale, get funded, and to become, part of this ecosystem.
Well, it's great to hear. It's great to hear. And we've talked on the podcast before with one of the companies involved in the sort of UK safety tech sector. And really exciting that this work is being done because the good that could come from that would be very significant and I think a great contributor to dealing with the problems we've talked about today. But John, thanks so much for sparing some of your time and joining us on the podcast. It's been great to talk to you again.
It was a pleasure. Nice to chat.
You've been listening to the Infotagent podcast, hosted by me, Damien Collins, and featuring John Borthwick. It was produced by Lucy and David Dargahi. You can find out more about Infotagent, the independent COVID-19 fact-checking service recommended by Ofcom, and send us examples of disinformation you've seen by visiting our website, infotagent.com, or using #IsolateTheLies on Twitter, Instagram, and Facebook. Thank you. Until next time.